Well, hello everyone, and welcome back to yet another episode of the Deeper Podcast. I'm Austin Slater, that's Dan Kinnis, and I don't know when you're listening to this, but as we're recording this, holy cow, it is so snowy and blizzardy. It is very gross outside. It took me an hour and a half, what normally takes 40 minutes to drive up here for work. So it's very wintry. Mm-hmm. And so, Dan, I wanted to ask you, and do you have any special, like, hot chocolate recipes or things you do to, like, cozy up, stay warm?
Yeah. I don't mind hot chocolate, that's for sure. I'm not a coffee guy, so sometimes I'll get hot chocolate in its stead. But, yeah, you know, it's we're in the winter wonderland right now. We're getting it this year. And, yeah, just oftentimes just staying inside and trying not to be out too much in it. But, yeah, like you said, the roads today, if you're driving around listening to us, be careful out there.
Honestly, if you're driving around listening to us, turn us off and focus on the road and then come back.
Right, yeah, it's sketchy out there right now. So.
It's nasty. Yeah, one of the things that we used to do growing up with, like, our hot chocolate. And so, actually, first off, I want to put out a request. If you who are listening have, like, a special homemade hot chocolate recipe you have, I want to hear it. Send it to me. Text it to me. I don't care. I want to hear it. My family used to do, we used to make our own powder. Mm. And we actually used to put a little pudding in that.
Okay.
And that just thickened it up so good. And you put a little bit of the, like, peppermint salt. Mm. Mm. So I'm a big hot cocoa guy. So if any of y'all have good hot cocoa, I want to hear about it because this is the week for it.
Please share. And next week sounds like two. So.
Yes. Yeah. To get onto the real stuff, though, Dan, let's just jump right into this. What did we talk about on Sunday?
So we've been doing this second Advent series, acknowledging that we're always in this life waiting for Christ's return. And so in the season of Advent, and we've been taking in some text from Revelation 3, 4, 5 to think about how do we wait in the meantime. And so last week in this, in Revelation 3, with some of these messages to the churches from Jesus, and this week was Laodicea, which is the last of those. And a very, attention-grabbing word from Jesus. It's hard to not kind of be hit by what he says there because it's so stark and it's so visual. And so we talked about Jesus saying, I'm going to spit you or vomit you out of my mouth. We had a children's message earlier where Rod spit out some water. So everybody had that visual firmly in mind. And just that expression of disgust, really, that's part of that. So we talked about, Why is that the case? What's going on? And the expression of being lukewarm, and then what's behind that? They see themselves as very self-reliant, and, we've acquired all this wealth. We're doing great. But Jesus is saying it's actually the opposite. You're not doing well at all. And but then saw, too, his encouraging word at the end. Despite all that concern for the church and reprimand of the church, there is powerful promises at the end in a very positive fashion. So there's the gospel. We said often when we're disgusted by something, we are trying to stay away from it, and yet Jesus comes right into it with us in order to draw us out of that and redeem us. So, yeah, very powerful word. And I know talking to a few afterwards, for one thing, you can't really deny some of the similarities in situation in our particular context to that.
That really stuck out to me as we were. I was like, oh my goodness! Like, if we were any of these church writ large,
sure,
were any of these churches, I feel like it's Laodicea, which that's not a great feeling.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of these messages in Scripture in general. I mean, there's some things in each of them you could probably tie into and say, oh yeah, but the situation of the wealth and that kind of self-reliance that we talked about, I mean, that's us. Yeah, we definitely have that. So the danger's there. We can always talk about to what degree we've gone down this road. But so I think it seemed like it had all of our attention, which is what Jesus is clearly trying to do. And that's grace as well. So, yeah, we're going to dig a little deeper into it. But I'm thankful we had some time Sunday already to reflect on it together.
Me too. I think this is probably one of the most convicting of the letters. Mm-hmm. So I love that we were talking about this. And I was wondering, so I've read these for years, and we've talked about them for a long time, and I don't think I've ever actually heard, was there ever any follow-up from any of these churches? Mm-hmm. I mean, these churches are sent out. It's the starting half of our book of Revelation. Unless, most of us are scholars, we don't necessarily know what happened.
Right.
So did the church in Laodicea decide to, turn themselves around? How do you happen to know any of that?
So in Laodicea's case, it seems like there was some heeding to this word from the Lord, because we know a couple hundred years after this, there was a synod there at this church, right, in Laodicea. So clearly there was still vibrancy going on a couple hundred years afterwards. And, yeah, of course, we know over the long term of history, things have changed. But and some we have more information on than others, like Ephesus was pretty prominent. So we know that continued to be, a church and center and a Christian center. Like Philadelphia, we know that the next century there was some writings about I think it was maybe Ignatius. I can't remember which one of the church fathers was there on his way actually to being martyred. So we have some information that the churches were still there, at least in the couple centuries afterwards.
Okay.
But I think it's encouraging in Laodicea's case, all this negative word that. Again, Jesus' word had impact. If they were meeting there a couple hundred years later, things hadn't just snuffed out. So
that is really encouraging, and that's really encouraging for us again in our modern context as we look at these and we're like, man, if Jesus were writing to the Church of America, what would he say? Like, well, you know what's good is he wrote this to the church in Laodicea, and if they're still moving strong with the Lord hundreds of years later, so that's just so encouraging. So thanks for answering that. I was curious. I did think it was really interesting about how the major issue for the Church of Laodicea was that they were neither spiritually healing nor spiritually refreshing. And I just think that's so interesting that that was what Jesus chose to highlight, because when we think about the role and like the goal of churches in a community, often those things are kind of secondary. You'll see a lot about, equipping people to know the Word and to love God and all this stuff. And the spiritual renewal comes as a result of the community that's been built or a result of the teaching. And it's not necessarily like, no, this is our goal, is we want you to be spiritually renewed first and foremost. It could be an unsaid goal. Either way, it's just an interesting. I just thought that was interesting. And so I was wondering if you have any just thoughts on that in general, and then what it might look like if we were to make the spiritual refreshingness and the spiritual healing element as core versus maybe as like a secondary as a result sort of thing.
And depending on your context, there certainly are churches that have made this the priority and perhaps have gone over top with that and missed the other side, right?
So there is that.
In some ways, we need the orthodoxy, right, the right belief, and the orthopraxy, the right practice. We need both, really, and they're supposed to go together. So, for example, the church in Ephesus, we didn't do that one, but Jesus calls them out. You know, you're really good on your orthodoxy. You hate these practices of these kind of false teachings, but you're not loving very well. That's what he says to them. You're kind of forgotten your first love. And in this case, maybe something similar. Jesus doesn't say anything bad necessarily about Laodicea's belief. He doesn't say you're following these false teachings. None of that comes up. It does in other letters, so we know he certainly would address it if it was there. But it's just they're not following through their practice. It's just lethargic. Like we said, they're kind of halfway in. They're going through the motions, but it's not really, and you could tell that's more self-serving. And so that to get to your question about that focus, it's interesting, right? In a lot of our churches and our tradition, too, we've been quite careful about our orthodoxy, right? And very well thought out. We have these creeds and confessions that lay out what we believe and why we believe it, and all that's very good. But our emphasis has typically been there. So, how do we make sure that we are bearing fruit? In some ways, you could say because we've had this great foundation, we could put more focus on the practice and being those who are bringing the refreshment and healing of God's kingdom to each other and to the world around us as well. And we always need to keep an eye on that, because you can be prone if you just get out, trying to be, there's a whole social gospel movement that happened. Well, some of the orthodoxy can get lost if you're only focusing on, bringing the cup of water to somebody, right? And so you need both. You do need both. But in our setting, we're probably more prone to forget this part as well, or to think we're doing it, but really we're kind of doing it just for ourselves in a way, and not so much, or when it's really pretty comfortable for me to do it. And I know we might talk about that too. So I think we need both. And that's where the church at large, if there's a church down the road who's doing this part really well, we can benefit and learn and say, how are they going about that? We need to be doing that. And maybe they could learn from us of how do we keep careful about making sure we're maintaining what we believe and who we're following and all those kind of things as well. It's like we talked about, I think it was on this podcast a couple of weeks ago about kind of the Pentecostal versus those who are less so, and what can we learn from each other as far as following the lead of the Spirit and interacting with Him. In this case, too, again, learning. And even in the church, we have people who are very apologetic, right? They want to know all those details, and they can think that way, and they can help others think that way. And others who are very relationally minded, thinking about, you know, how I can bless someone else, and we certainly can benefit from that, too. So, yeah, sometimes these things are almost set up as rivals, and like, no,
and that's... It is a both and. It is not a zero-sum game.
No. They you said it up front. They're supposed to contribute to each other, and that's why I think Jesus is so strong when it's like, if I'm, you know, very strong in my orthodox, but this practice isn't there, Jesus would say, well, you probably need to look at your orthodoxy again. And if I say my practice is so right, but I'm, you know, not confessing Jesus, or I'm getting like, well, anybody can kind of, whoever you're following, come in. Jesus said, no, you're off on that too. This isn't jiving together. You got good things there, but you're missing the main point. So, and I think scripturally, a lot of the issue that we see is more slanted toward the, and this is probably because it's written a lot to the church. Well, we got our belief right, but we're not really living that out well, versus the other way. But there's danger both ways, right? You see, certainly in Paul's letters, you see some of the danger of, you know, people who are trying to be, you know, very kind of libertine, and they're living it out, and they're probably trying to accept others in their culture and bring them in, but they're missing, you know, the heart of the faith and the change of life that's come about in Jesus Christ. So, yeah, it's a good question, and we need to make sure we're looking at how we're doing on both sides.
Absolutely. And one thing I'd encourage, this is, you know, something I work on myself, and I'd encourage all of y'all who are listening in on this, is identify people who are really good at both of those things, mm-hmm. Or even just one of those things. Someone who's really good at the orthodoxy, someone who's really good at the orthopraxy, mm-hmm. and learn from both of them. And that's really going to be the way to get around this problem is mm-hmm. we need to be seeing how both of these things are lived out well.
Yeah.
So you're just taking a few moments and thinking like, okay, who can be a mentor for me in the practice? Who can be a mentor for me in the learning?
Yeah.
How can I make sure that I am refreshing and healing and also like loving God well? I think that's just, you know, really important. You got to get both of these.
Yeah. And our teaching too, right? To not be just focused on the head. There's a part to like make sense of those, but where does this flow out of my hands, right? So one of our discipleship lessons, we talk about a little the faith, right? And where that falls, does God create that faith in us? And all, it's fine to talk about that. Here's the Arminian view. Here's the Reform view. Well, what's the point? You know, it's good to get that down, to think about the scripture that's connected. But the goal of that too is to realize we need to have, and the lesson talks about being kind of the teeth of the gospel and having our gospel teeth out, because God calls us to share that because he's preparing people to receive that message. And but if we're not, we're just like saying, oh, I've learned all that stuff, I got all this, and then I'm living my life not looking to share it with anybody or to represent that, whether it's intellectually teaching the gospel or actively showing it through acts of mercy, well, what's the point, right? Again, you're missing the part of the equation there of how this goes out in my hands. So whatever doctrine we could be talking about, it's a good way to think about how do we teach not just the head part of that, but where it comes into my hands and from my heart too.
Absolutely. So. Thanks for that, Dan. One thing I do want to hit on a little bit is on how you said at one point the people of Laodicea's lives were more about self-service than self-sacrifice. Which, again, you know, I mean, and you said this, and I think anyone who's listening would probably agree, like, if we're like any of these churches as a culture, we're like Laodicea. We're all about that self-sufficiency. We're all about, I can do this. It's that can-do. It's the whole American dream. And the experiment is like, I want to be free to do what I want on my own without interference from anybody, mm-hmm. Which we obviously know is not the Christian understanding of things.
Sure.
It's kind of our whole point. We're fallen, we're sinful, we need Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering, given our odd place of where, at least for most people listening, you're in the States. I know we do have some listeners who are outside of the States. But for those of us who are here in the States, and we're in this self-sufficiency stew,
mm-hmm.
as it were, and it's everything about the air we breathe and the culture we live in, how can we, first off, move away from that, and then how can we be self-sacrificial in a way that is truly self-sacrificial when we do have so much affluence around us?
Yeah. Well, again, I think these things go together and flow together well, right? If if I truly understand the gospel, which starts with recognizing my need of salvation, and I can't do this on my own, and there's a problem between God and I need Jesus Christ, right, to provide for me, and his salvation comes about through his self-sacrifice, right? This is his way of saving, that he goes to the cross for us. Well, that will create, I believe, in me then not only a knowledge that I can't do everything on my own, but also this desire to, has seen others sacrifice to help me my needs. There's people with needs all around me, whether they acknowledge them or not. And for those to need be met, they need to know Jesus primarily, but also I can help meet needs. But that's going to take sacrifice on my part also to do that, right? But understanding the gospel drives me to want to live that way because I'm so filled with joy that Jesus has done this for me. So I think, you know, we talked about it, like self-sufficiency, it's not like a bad thing in and of itself to, you know, we shouldn't be just completely dependent on everyone else. We've been given gifts and abilities and wisdom, and we can do things, and that's great. It's just that danger of thinking we can do everything for ourselves. And if we're being honest, truly honest, even if we say, oh, I made my own way in this, in my business or whatever, no, you didn't. Tons of people helped you along the way, yeah. Right? I mean, just think about your upbringing. You know, there's parents who, you would, many years of your life, you were completely dependent on people.
I saw this one comedian do a little sketch for a little bit on Jeff Bezos or, you know, Bill Gates, one of these computer guys who, like, he started, you know, Microsoft in his garage, like, and how, you know, he did, you know, and he did all this stuff from his garage and he just did it himself. And it's like, I'm trying to get to the point where I have a functioning garage. Like, he had that to start with.
Right. Well, yeah, that myth of a self-made man.
Right.
And we use that term all the time. And I know there's something behind it, but that's never really true. There's always people there with us who help us, who maybe give us an initial loan so we can fund the things we want to do. Well, you didn't just come. Somebody had to help you, right? And again, to teach you things. You went to school to learn things. Life lessons. People were teaching you and mentoring you along the way. And so, yes, you might have come from very humble origins. That should even drive more self-sacrifice if that's the case. But there's always others that we've depended on who have given of their time, of their resources, sacrificed, one might say, so that you could have this opportunity. And so I think just that awareness that this is kind of a myth that we're self-sufficient, even in any good country. When we're functioning well here, it's because we're looking out and helping each other, and there's systems to do that through. Yes, we don't want to be leeches. Nobody should be doing that. There's ones who, because of their health or other reasons, need more help. But yeah, we're all dependent on the sacrifice and the help of others, whether that's parents, whether that's other resources coming our way, people help us in business, people teach me sports things, you know. So it shouldn't come as a surprise, really, that, well, we need God over and above all of this. It's this deception of the culture that I'm making my own way. And we talked about it with Laodicea that, yeah, if they looked just on the surface, like, we rebuilt our own city. They had several billionaires of the day that lived there. They had the Bill Gates and the Elon Musks that lived in Laodicea, several big names that you wouldn't know unless you were kind of a history nerd. But they were the billionaires of the day. They chose to live there, so they had all the money funding these buildings. But in reality, again, those people have been built up by others, or people probably had made fortunes before them and passed that down. And who taught you how to build that building? Somebody. You didn't just all of a sudden figure it out, probably. You know, so that reminder of, oh, yeah, I've always kind of been building on something else. And even technology-wise, right? You mentioned, like, you know, Apple computers or IBM or Microsoft. Mm-hmm. Or, well, there was others doing research with some of these things before that, and they built off that, and they built off that. And so, I don't know, that's helpful for me to realize, as we look at our culture where we are, you know, can do a lot of things for ourselves, that's really a myth when it comes down to it. There's always the need of others around us, even human beings, let alone in the spiritual sense when it comes to God. And that reminder that Scripture brings up, Paul says it in those famous words in, like, Ephesians 2, you were dead in your sins. It's not like, oh, yeah, well, we were hanging on by a thread.
It's like, you're gone.
You were spiritually dead, and that's God's breathing down new life into you. Like, there's literally nothing you could have done for yourself here. You're completely dependent on God to do something here, and he's done it for us in Jesus. So going back to Scripture can remind us, too, of that great need. But I don't know if I got off track from what you initially asked.
No, that was, I mean, that was pretty much exactly where I was wanting to go with this. Just again, just recognizing like real self-sacrifice does require us to first off acknowledge other people's sacrifices and then sacrifice ourselves.
Yeah, and you were thinking about the, you know, even acknowledging or how am I aware where I'm maybe serving more myself than looking out around? I mean, because there are things we do need to do for ourselves. I mean, you can't just go, well, I hope, you know, somebody dumped some food on my plate today. I mean,
like those kind hope of, someone drives me to work today.
Right, exactly. I mean, yeah, there's, you know, there's a level of looking after ourselves we need to do. But I think we can just look in a larger scale and say, yeah, how am I? And I think this can be encouraging too, right? If you're listening, you're a parent with younger kids. Sometimes you think, oh, I'm not giving much time right now to different ministries and that. Well, you are, in this season, with young kids especially, sacrificing a lot for them.
Absolutely.
Sleep, maybe first and foremost. But you're pouring a lot in. That may be what God's calling you to right now, and that's okay. There's a lot of self-sacrifice there in parenting. And then as you get to different stages, maybe it looks different. But
that was actually one of the things that I learned growing up as a missionary kid. Was that we would sometimes have people come out on the field who they have this deep desire to be, you know, serving the people in Uganda around them, and they were ignoring the mission field of their own families while they were at that. And just realizing that, you know, if you have, especially if you're a parent, like, your first and most important mission field is your children right now. And so it might not feel like you're able to give as much in some areas, but be encouraged by where you are giving.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know.
Fruit comes from that, too, like you said. And that's listening to God, too. Where is he calling? And even that mindset is a good one, because then we're thinking outside of ourselves, where is God calling me to serve? That's a good question. Or what does that look like for me now? That's exploring how I can be living for the Lord and his purposes, right? Mm-hmm. To be refreshing, to be bringing blessing and healing, whatever that looks like. So, yeah.
All right, one more question for you. Is there ever a time where we can and should say, I am spitting you out, metaphorically, to another person who professes Christ? Mm. So when we're looking at this passage, you know, God is really saying, like y'all aren't living it. Mm. I'm disgusted with you. I'm spitting you out. Mm. But that is God saying that. That is notably not us.
Sure.
And it's really tricky sometimes to navigate the, and especially in regards to like church discipline and stuff, but it can be really tricky because on the one hand, we are supposed to be there to encourage, to uplift, to redirect, to live in community with people who are not living like Christ.
Right.
Even people who profess Christ. Like that is part of our life ministry. We all have to do this. But it sits weird to me sometimes, when, especially when you look at church history, when you look at things like excommunication. It's kind of saying, like, you know what? You're so messed up that I don't have to deal with my responsibility to you as a brother to uplift you, to encourage you, to rebuild you. It's like I'm spitting you out. I'm done with you. And you can see that happen all throughout church history. And it doesn't happen as much now, because now, okay, you know, friendship kicked me out. I'll just go to the church across the street, right? It's now that we're no longer in, like, just the Catholic Church era.
Sure, sure.
It does look a little different, but still, the concept behind that still feels weird. How do we balance that?
Yeah, it's a good question, because that is, I think, from a church perspective, the idea of excommunication is the, like you said, it feels like the spitting out of the mouth. What we have to always remember in regards to church discipline is the principles, right? We can apply that, and I think we sometimes need to, in our context, in maybe a different way than maybe Paul or Peter was talking about how they did it in their context. But the principles underneath that, right, it's meant to be done in love. It's meant to be done with an eye toward this person coming back into the fellowship and back into the faith of believing in Jesus Christ. And at that time, it was a pretty strong way of doing that, was to say, we're going to kind of remove you from the fellowship because you really don't have connecting points. You've rejected the culture around us, and now you're getting removed from the church. So there was a lot of pressure to say, this will draw you back in. But that doesn't work in our context so well now, because even if I'm not going to go to another church, usually I've already, quote-unquote, excommunicated myself from the church before you say that. Like, I'm already not going to the church because I don't agree with you about this topic or that doctrine or whatever it might be. So there is a place, perhaps, and over history, that's supposed to be the goal. When you excommunicated, that someone would become aware of their sins. And that was, especially in the Reformed tradition, that was like the last step of a multi-step process, where there was a conversation with counsel, there was a warning, there was a note that was sent, there was all these things. And then finally, when there was no, a desire to repent shown, that was kind of the last step. But still, the goal there was that this might, like Jesus' word, draw someone to wake up, open their eyes, and say, oh, I've been living. And so, yeah, in churches, there was times when someone who'd been excommunicated repented, and then there was this celebration of someone rejoining the community and living the life. That's the goal. How we go about it, right, is needs to be kept in mind, for what does that look like now? How are we talking to people that, in the past, it was maybe a big social thing. Like, if I get kicked out of the church, I live in this small community. Everybody knows. I feel like I'm an outcast now. Well, that's not the case as much anymore. So how do we interact? If someone is getting off track, what's the best way to try and draw them in and love? Sometimes it maybe is a stern word to get their attention. Other times it might take a different approach, because sometimes we're almost communicating into the air. Mm-hmm. These things like, oh, so-and-so has been removed, and they've already stopped coming a year ago. They've kind of removed themselves. So what's the point of that? And is this really trying to bring them back? And
And I think that's really so key as you look at just the concept of discipline in general, church discipline specifically. Like, the goal of this is not to punish for bad behavior. The goal of this is to restore relationship and restore fellowship. It's, there's a phrase I'm looking for in the sociology world. And of course I've lost it, even though I almost got a degree in it.
Yeah.
But it's like restorative justice. That's mm-hmm. the word I'm looking for. And looking at like the whole point of this is to restore a relationship mm-hmm. back to something it should be. And I think that's really something that I'm glad you said that. Like, our goal should be the restoration. That's what we're trying to do when
right.
these moments come.
Right.
And it's not for saying, you have done these things, you've earned this bad.
Right. You bad, we good.
You bad, we good. And right. like, you've yeah. checked the line, you did the bad thing, you get the bad thing.
Right.
Whereas like, this is much more like, you did the bad thing and I love you so much, I want you to come back.
Right. Jesus addresses that in this passage, right? He says, those I love, I rebuke and discipline. Like, it's more worrisome if he didn't say anything. Like, oh man, like, he's not even talking to us anymore. But Jesus comes and has this word because he loves them and he wants them to be drawn back and he wants them to live fruitful lives as he's made them for. And so I think from the church, right, that should come, but we got to think about how we're doing that so it's communicated, like, we're doing this and we're talking to you because we care about you. If we just blew you off, I mean, that would say something, but that's not what we want to do. Just how do we communicate that? It's so different now. And I don't have an exact answer. I've been wrestling with this for a while. Like, we need to talk about discipline and we need to hold each other accountable. But the methods we probably used even 70 years ago are probably not going to be as effective, right? That we need to know the principles underneath. How do we apply it now in our time? And so anyways, and even in the church, like, when someone was excommunicated, say removed from membership, there is, kind of the understanding and the writing of the church is like, well, now you pursue that person through evangelism, right? So it's even then, like, well, we haven't given up. Like, so I think that gets forgotten too. It's kind of like you said, becomes this like, well, we did our work. We kind of freed ourselves of the responsibility. No, now we're witnessing to this person. We're trying still to draw them back. That should always be our direction. We want, everyone to believe. We want people to know Jesus Christ and put their faith in him, whether that's they started from inside the church and there's been problems and they've gone out or they've always been outside. That should be our heart, right? Mm-hmm. That should be, again, that healing and refreshment comes through the gospel. So, it's a good question. There's a lot more thought that can go into it.
As with all of these questions, we could probably write books, and there have been books written about almost all of them.
Yeah.
Imagine,
yeah.
We live in a complicated and difficult world. Crazy.
Right, yeah, yeah. You can always go deeper and deeper, right?
Yes. our next podcast will be deeper yeah. too.
That's right, right, to the center of the earth. So.
What are we going to be doing next week, Dan?
This coming Sunday, I have a new unique opportunity. The church I served in Zeeland, Bethel Christian Reformed Church, is celebrating their 75th birthday. So they're doing a celebration and service. They asked previous pastors, members to come back and share memories and enjoy that. So I'm going to be there Sunday morning with them, Lord willing. Looking forward to that time to celebrate with that community we were a part of for many years. And so Pastor Eric's going to be continuing this series. And Revelation 4 which is now we take kind of this vision and Jesus' word to the church, and now we're all of a sudden transported to the throne of God in heaven. And so Jesus' last word to the church is there about, I'll give you the right to sit on my throne with me, and all of a sudden we see the throne. And so thinking about how do we wait, I think Pastor Eric's going to be saying we need to focus on the throne and who's seated upon it and the worship that's going on there, right? That should be central in our lives too. So I'm sure I'll have to catch it, not live, but in another fashion. But I'm looking forward to that word in Revelation 4 and helping us to think again about how we're waiting on the Lord.
Yeah, that'll be some good stuff. I'm so excited for that. Well, thanks for all of you who have been listening and joining in. We're so blessed by your participation in this. And we will see you next time.